Hey guys, Jim Cox, and I'm here today with an interview with Kate Gardner. We had actually been connected by a mutual friend, Amy Hall, on Facebook, and she suggested we talk. And here we are. And we had had a chance to talk a little bit before about the work that she does. So I think it's going to be a great conversation about what we need to do to fix the current morass, economic morass that we're in order to get to where we need to be for the planet. So, Kate, thanks for taking time to chat today.
Hi, James. Thanks so much. I'm excited to talk with you.
Awesome. So, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved in terms of, I guess, redesigning how to think about the economy based on sustainability? Because that's kind of the work that you focus on, right?
Well, how about this? I take a portion of an economy. I
Okay.
like to focus on manufacturing, so the manufacturing industry, although I don't exclusively do that. I am the founder and CEO of a consulting firm that focuses on the implementation of business circularity within manufacturing.
Okay.
And that's a mouthful. So I like to look at for-profit companies. I like to work with manufacturing organizations, and I am interested in hoping to change the system for them of production, of consumption, and of material use and reuse. Of course, that one piece, that consumption side is both thinking about how companies, brands, manufacturing firms can support individuals to consume in different ways.
So that's a lot to take in, and it feels like rolling a boulder up a mountain, I must, just in my mind. So how did you decide that that's what you wanted to do? Like, what was your journey to get from, a college graduate to, this is something that I actually need to do?
Yeah, when I, it's an interesting point of reference. So I went to Dartmouth College and I had a government degree with a minor. They didn't have minors at the time, but a minor in economics. But I wasn't an environmentalist. I wasn't really thinking about environmental studies at the time. And I'm going to take a little side road off before I tell you the answer to your question. But at Dartmouth College, there was the great systems thinker, Donella Meadows. And she taught at Dartmouth College for almost 30 years in the environmental studies area. And she is one of my role models. Everyone knows about Donella, and she's a systems thinker. She talks about changing systems and how you do that and at what intervention points and which levers are more meaningful versus less meaningful. So I unfortunately did not have the opportunity to meet her and take in her wisdom one-on-one at Dartmouth. So I went out in the world. I went out and went into banking, and then I went into consulting, and then I went back to get my MBA at Wharton. And that's when I decided that I was really interested in starting a company. I wrote a couple of business plans, went out and worked at XM Satellite Radio. So I'm still very much in the old economic system of supply and demand and for profit and high growth. And then I wrote a business plan to start a women's sustainable activewear company. So I was going to design, manufacture, and sell sustainable activewear. I knew this was back in like 2003, 2004 is when I wrote that business plan and raised funds. And I knew that there was this J curve of understanding that sustainability was important. It was starting to infiltrate certain industries, definitely like interior design, the furniture industry, somewhat architecture and built infrastructure. Nike and Adidas in that sportswear, performance wear industry, they were sort of dipping their toes into putting, you know, a very small portion of sustainable fibers or fabrics into a small portion of their apparel mix. That's significantly changed in the intervening years. But I knew that sustainability was going to be our future. And I didn't have the marketing muscle or the cash flow of some of these bigger companies as a startup activewear company. So I said, you know what, I'm going to start way up in that high growth portion of the J curve, economic term. And I'm going to go all out, full in on sustainability. So I started my company, my women's sustainable activewear company, as a fully sustainable manufacturing idea. So I did most of my fabrications that were put into my clothes were either 95% some kind of organic fiber fabric, 5% Lycra spandex, or 98.2 or 100% organic or sustainable fibers. I also had a store in Brooklyn, New York on Atlantic Avenue, a flagship store. And I sold my clothes and other people's clothes. I sold accessories related to, you know, Pilates, yoga, Tai Chi, the gym. I sold body products and things of that sort, but everything had this lens of, it had to either be 100% USDA organic, all natural, had to have sustainable fibers, it had to be biodegradable. So the whole mix of merchandise in my store also sort of embodied sustainability. And so I opened that store, I manufactured my goods, I sold my products that were made of sustainable fibers, and people would walk in, or I was talking to wholesalers, and they say, oh, that's really great. How are they sustainable? Okay. What about the inks that you put into your fabrics? What about the thread that you use? What about your packaging? And so they kept on bringing me, as I now know, I didn't have the terminology then, they kept on bringing me back upstream in my value chain and kept on asking me, well, yeah, but where else are you sustainable? And that was my first, like, okay, I'm getting a lot of pushback. I had to educate consumers on the value of sustainability and purchasing in a sustainable way. And then after that business, I had that for about 9 years. I went back to get my second master's, my master's of science in sustainable management. And I focused on industrial ecology. So business circularity is a framework for thinking about the concepts, the really specific applicable concepts of industrial ecology within a manufacturing system. And so I focused on that, got my second degree, and then decided to go out and apply my learnings with other companies.
So a lot to unpack there, but what's most impressive to me is the fact that, you know, you see a lot of people who in the field who talk about sustainability, but don't have any sort of background in the real economy. Like it seems to me there's a lot of ivory towerness to people trying to fill a role, you know, that's been created by a corporation, but it, you know, to actually understand the dynamic of running a company, trying to keep it profitable and still have it meet the needs of what your vision is for sustainability is a whole nother level. So, you know, congrats to you to go through that learning curve, you know, because that's, you know, that's priceless, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's important. A lot of the chief sustainability officers or the VPs of sustainability, they have a lot of knowledge in supply chain. So their supply chain managers and directors, often they come from merchandising and procurement sourcing of materials, because again, circularity is all about the materials that you do use And then how do you craft a product? So what we're starting to get to at that stage is the designers, the R&D folks, the engineers, the product designers, and they really have to be educated in end of life design and product design. And then of course we need to change the system at the end of life, right? Or end of use. But a lot of these people are coming to sustainability with some significant knowledge of supply chains.
So you talk about the circular dynamic. Is that kind of like donut economics? I mean, I've heard that term before. Is that comparable or is that analogous?
Rayworth, she's awesome.
This is a term from an economist in England, right?
Yeah, Kate Rayworth. Yeah. She's fantastic. I mean, a lot of these, like Herman Daly, circularity. Yeah, it's this idea that you drive an economy sustainably using resources that are renewable, and you're not using more than we have, more than the Earth's capacity currently, and that you're actually being able to restore the ability to have and maintain those resources over time. Right. So yeah, they're all getting, there's angles at it. I think they're more of a holistic approach. You know, again, my real focus on business circularity is very much, I mean, there's a lot that goes into it, but it really is about material use and the revalorization of those materials. And then the consumptive model, how do brands and manufacturers design and support their products for the consumer's use in a way that's different than just keep on pumping out new products. So that at, you know, when a consumer says, oh, I'm done with this phone, they just throw it away. Or when, oh, I'm done with something, they just throw it away. Instead, they recapture that and they disassemble those products in a way like what is talked about in Cradle to Cradle, the book Cradle to Cradle, which is anything that can go back to Earth or is biological nutrients, right? Like food waste, right? We carve out food waste and it can go back to the Earth and create really fertile soils, right? So that's good. We should bring that back to the Earth. We shouldn't put that somewhere in a black box, a cement black box, so it can just rot and do nothing. But technical nutrients, metals, and also plastics, all the various different types of plastics, they need to be cordoned off, single material to cordon off, so that we can do something with them, decontaminate them, depolymerize them, melt them down, and then build them back up to make new products. They should not go back to Earth, right? And so it's the idea of manufacturing circularity, business circularity, there's all these points of thinking about how to make that happen in the most optimal, beneficial way.
So is there the technology right now to exist to do that, to break down, let's say, an iPhone into its component rare earth metals and not necessarily keep the parts intact, but the minerals and so forth so that they can be reused? I would imagine it's fairly complex and energy intensiveness you can get over by, you know, using solar and wind. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a huge negative, but I would imagine it takes a lot of time and manpower and energy to do that.
I think you're right. So the good news about electronic waste or electronics is most of them are metal, right? They're just metals, a whole bunch of variety of metals. The problem, so that's good news. The good news is all metals are almost 100% recyclable, right? So you're going to lose some in the process of you know, melting them down and building them back up. But frankly, they're infinitely recyclable, right? And that's true of steel and aluminum and all these other ones. But the problem with electronic waste and electronics is it's time consuming, right? To take all of those electronics, to open them, and then to pick out all the various different metals, put them in the right lanes, melt them down, so that they could be built back up again. So it's time consuming. A lot of these electronics companies, manufacturers, they make it really difficult to disassemble their products. So that's an issue. So iFixit.com is a company that is really calling out these manufacturing, electronic manufacturing brands and saying, well, one, we should have the right to repair this stuff and to be able to get into them easily to repair, but also it's at the end of life again. So think about not just repairing it, but finally, maybe they can't be repaired. Well, then if you make it easy for them to be opened and disassembled, then we can revalorize all those different materials. But yes, it's difficult. It's time consuming. It's expensive, so not profitable, right, for the manufacturers or anybody right now. And yes, it's energy intensive.
So the key, though, in what you're saying is it goes back to the original design process of how they're put together to begin with to make it easier to disassemble at the end. And that's really kind of the key conundrum. So how do you get into Apple's front door to say, hey, why don't you do it this way instead? And that can actually be downstream an economic positive for you, because then you don't have to worry as much about your supply chain, you know?
This is about systems change fundamentally, right? Yeah. So these manufacturers, the system of manufacturing is, and the where the profit is, where the growth opportunity is you think of new ideas, you build those products, you sell them, and you say, that was really successful. Wow, great. Let's go back to the drawing board and let's do that again. And let's do that faster and faster. That's where planned obsolescence came in, because instead of something lasting 20 years, 10 years, 5 years, let's make it break. Let's make it good for 1.5, 2 years. So they're forced to buy a new product.
Yeah.
Right. So it's funny, you know, I just bought a house about 6 years ago. It came with new washers and dryers. They just went kaput. I don't know, maybe 6 months ago. And I said, you know, I brought the guy out and we tried to fix. He's like, it's not even worth fixing. It's going to cost you more to fix these washers and dryers than it is just to buy new ones. And I said, wait a minute.
That's crazy.
When I was growing up, washers and dryers were durable.
Right? Yeah, Maytag man, right? Maytag man didn't have anything to do because he never needed to fix anything.
Exactly. They were like, they last a lifetime. They were super durable. It's just the last 15, 20, 25 years. He's like, no, they're made now to last 3 to 5 years max. And I said, well, that's not a durable good. And he's like, it just makes more sense to, like, you know, build them and then replace them every 3 to 5 years. That's the way it's gone. And so that's also planned obsolescence, right? It's just too expensive, too costly for these manufacturers to build something to last. But that's where we have to go back to. We have to go back to that. And if it's not going to last, then you build it for repair. You build it for, you know, so it can be repaired, and it's a service model of manufacturing. I'll give you another example. I have a grinder. It's a European, actually it's based out of Colorado, I think, but it's a grinder. So I love my coffee. I can put, you know, huge amounts of coffee beans in it, and it grinds automatically, and it grinds to a certain level. You can do finer grain or coarser grain, depending if you want French press or you want an Italian espresso. And I love it. But, you know, the grinder can get worn down. So after, you know, maybe 3 or 4 years, it also goes kaput. And the great news is this company, and a lot of them will say, listen, we'll repair that for you. and we'll repair it at a cost, but not at the cost. It's maybe a third of the cost of replacing it. So it makes sense. Okay, you ship it back. We can do it in 10 days. It'll cost you $189. It'll be good as new. That's where we need to go with a lot of products that you can buy in the market today.
That makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that you said, which really struck a chord, is this idea of planned obsolescence and the idea that we're pushing the limits of planetary boundaries, and we're pushing these boundaries on purpose. It's not that it's an accident that this is happening. It's that it's done on purpose to really keep pushing the bounds farther of how far we can push the planet. And the reality is we can't afford to do that anymore.
We can't, on purpose. It's hard because the Industrial Revolution was based on this idea that there was unlimited resources for our use and purpose, right? So it's, again, a system of thinking about the planet and what it provides us economically. So we bought into that system. We accelerated that system in the 1950s after World War II, right? To keep production moving, keep the growth of the economy going, continuous growth of GDP. But the reality is there have been externalities, right? Negative externalities. And they're getting increasingly, they're getting angry, right? The planet's getting very angry with us. And so they're hard to ignore now. And we have to, but the system's been around for a really long time. It's been globally adopted. So there's people out there calling for change, like a Kate Raworth, right, with Donut Economics, like a Herman Daly, like a Danella Meadows, where we have to actually deconstruct the system, change it, replace it. That's very, very difficult to do. We're starting to coalesce around the idea that we need to do that. But it's a wicked problem because you can't just change the manufacturing system. You also have to change the financial system. You have to change the political system because every system has bought into GDP, continuous growth at all costs. In that, we back in the Industrial Revolution days, and I'm sure you've heard this, is that we had this very, it was a fallacy, but this belief that industry was separate from community and the planet, right? That we just operated outside of all those bounds. But the reality is it's constrained by those bounds. Yeah.
Yeah.
Problem.
So the question is, how do we as a society drive corporations and the business community to change? You can't just be through our decisions as consumers, because it seems like that's really not going to move things fast enough for what we need in order to meet our other needs in terms of what we're facing in terms of the climate and so forth. So is it a matter of the government, trying to drive innovation towards certain directions, such as resilience or looking at end of life or these kinds of design pieces because actually we're at a unique opportunity, right? I mean, we've gone through a process where for the last 20 years, we've basically offshored capitalism to other places where they can suffer the externalities. And in the past year, 2 years, we've seen with COVID the need to reshore business. And that whole process of reshoring is fundamentally changing, how corporations are thinking about, how they're going to do business going forward. So it's actually it's timely. you know, to be able to embrace this. The question is, how do we drive that to a more urgent, you know, factor in terms of decision-making for companies? Because, I mean, is it just a top-down, you know, the CEO comes in and says, this is what we're going to do, you know, make it so, number one, and you know, we're off to the races. And, but then we're waiting around for one guy to make, to come into a particular company.
So I would say that it takes consistent and multi-levered pressure on organizations, industry to change. And they're already seen and feeling that, right? So the federal government passed, it's a funny little term, instead of the Build Back Better Act, it's going to be the Inflation Reduction Act. But that's just a, you know, that's just a name. It really is a heavy climate policy in there. So it is regulation and policies at the federal and state level. So in the United States, you have very strong policies being implemented on the West Coast, right? Washington, you can jump into Canada, California, Oregon. You also have a lot of policies happening in New York and New Jersey. So it's policy. You have the investor community. That's a pressure. So they're basically asking corporations to report on their environmental impact and their social impact. So taking a stakeholder capitalism approach and a climate mitigation approach to their businesses and business models and how they operate. So what that does is that they're forcing public companies right now to report, but they're also saying to private companies that want to go public or want to raise additional funds, the pool of investors is getting smaller and smaller for you, because social impact investors, that community is getting larger and larger. So if they are looking at your company and thinking about investing, but you're doing nothing around the environment or social causes, then they're not going to put their dollars into your business. That's going to ultimately hinder your growth and hinder your ability to be an ongoing entity. Then you have the consumers, right? The millennials and the Gen Zs, they are going to be the most impacted by climate change, right? We have climate change now, but even if we stopped putting greenhouse gas emissions into the air, it's going to take many, many, many years for those to abate and come down, right? Climate change will continue to grow for a period of time before it starts declining. So millennials and Gen Z and the next generations, I think it's alpha generation after Gen Z, they're highly impacted. They're also yelling and screaming about, what the hell have you been doing to us? Why haven't you taken this seriously? So they are, they're calling out companies, they're boycotting companies, they're ruining, trying to ruin their reputations. And oh, by the way, these are professionals, right? They're working right now in these organizations. They don't want to work for non-sustainable companies. And if they get into a company, they're going to be like, you got to do something about this, because otherwise I'm going to leave and I'm going to tell everybody else to leave. So that's, getting back to your answer, it's, you need a top-down approach, which is someone who's a visionary, someone who understands that sustainable practices and a sustainable way of producing products or operating brings value to an organization in the medium to long term, sometimes even the short term. And then the bottoms up is this groundswell of consumers and employees and these younger generations that are saying, we're not going to take it anymore. Mm-hmm. And they're colliding to really make some fundamental changes about how companies operate, whether they're manufacturing companies or not.
So it sounds like we have a lot of those conditions already in place. You know, you mentioned that you have an MBA, and one of the things that, you know, my partner is an economics professor, and, you know, she's more of a labor economist. So she's, you know, not your typical you know, Chicago Booth School economist. But how do a lot of the people that go into MBA programs are basically looking at getting skill sets to work in corporations to further advance the form of capitalism that we already currently have? And how do we, obviously your experience was different in terms of you went to learn about the circularity and trying to look at capitalism in a different way. Where are those sources of education for people who want to get a proper education in terms of how to help corporations transition? Are there certain schools? Do we need to change, for example, you know, the existing business schools, and how would we do that?
So when I went to get my MBA, there was no way to even concentrate or get a degree in sustainability. That's not true anymore. Okay. So a lot of these major top 10, top 20 business schools, they all have the ability, they have the ability to major in social impact investing. You can get a sustainable management degree or concentration. There has been a significant shift towards this idea that companies need to operate differently, and they need to be able to bring benefit to not just their stockholders, but to all their stakeholders, including the environment and communities and people, right? So I think that that shift has already happened. I'm sure it's not infused in all of the MBA programs, but when I was looking to go back to get a singular master's degree in sustainable management, you find them dotted all over Europe, right? So they're usually 2 to 5 year degrees, and they are standalone degrees. They're not embedded within a master's of business administration. Here in the United States, when I was looking, that was back in 2014, most of the sustainable management concentrations were embedded into the MBA programs. Now, you did have standalone programs at Stanford, and there's one in Denver, and there's definitely at Yale, one of the premier environmental management degrees. But you're seeing those proliferate in the United States as well.
Good.
And they are, I mean, my program was, my sustainable management program, when they taught economics, they talked about ecological economics and how we have to move away from neoclassical economics. But I only learned neoclassical economics both in my undergrad and in my MBA. So, It is eye-opening. It is a dramatic way, a new way of thinking about economy. That more and more people have to be exposed to that.
Definitely, definitely. So you mentioned Europe. I would imagine that Europe is further along this process of looking at things in this kind of circular nature, just because Europe seems to be leading in terms of sustainability outlook overall compared to kind of the political environment we've had in the United States. Is that correct? Or are there European companies that are leaders in kind of what you're describing?
Well, Ukraine has put a little bit of a wrench in that, hasn't it? So they're scrambling for natural gas and restarting their nuclear power plants. But yes, I always said, and I still say, that Europe is about 20 to 25 years ahead of us.
Wow.
In thinking about sustainability. They do have sticks, right? They have significant regulation put upon industry to do the right thing, right? To take care of the products at end of life, to pay into programs where they know that their products, plastic products, will be recycled in the right way. So they're much more highly regulated. They're an older, you know, they're older than us, potentially wiser. They have a denser, more urban land use environment. And of course, they have dwindling natural resources. Unfortunately for us in the United States and North America, we're rich in natural resources. Now, they're becoming scarcer, but you know, they've exhausted a lot of their natural resources. So they had to come to this realization sooner than we.
Well, if the Ukraine taught anything, it's that we need to accelerate this process towards sustainability even faster. You know, this whole idea that just relying on somebody else's
fossil fuels
or security, you know, it exposes you to other risks that, you know, ultimately impacts the economy and society as a whole. You know, it's not abstract.
Well, yeah, it's this whole idea of, oh gosh, man, we might not be able to heat our homes this winter. Like I'm thinking about Germany, but there's other countries that are in this predicament. Oh my gosh, what are we going to do? There's going to be civil unrest. And because we've been so reliant on cheap fossil fuels from Russia, and just by the very nature of them becoming a pariah because they invaded Ukraine, it's this come to Jesus moment of what are we going to do to ensure that we can power our economy and keep people happy and do the right thing. So there is going to be a backsliding, you know, to that other fossil fuel, natural gas. But I think that a lot of these countries are going to adopt nuclear power as the transition power to renewable energy.
That's interesting because nuclear takes a lot of time to get up and going anyway, and obviously has its own safety and pollution concerns that are separate from climate-related ones. Are there leaders in terms of companies that are embracing this circularity in the United States? Are there corporate leaders?
There are corporate leaders. I mean, so when you're a smaller company, let's just say, you know, $1 billion in revenue and smaller, it's easier. You're more nimble. You're more flexible. Your supply chain is not as complicated. It doesn't have to be as redundant. So you can have these leaders like Patagonia, like but you have, I mean, Nike, I believe, for instance, Nike Inc., that's in my backyard. I mean, I do think they are taking this very, very seriously. They are sourcing renewable energy and all across the world. They're starting to support their suppliers, at least their tier one suppliers, and moving in the direction of becoming basically powering themselves more sustainably. They are growing, like Adidas, which is a German company. They're growing their portfolio, their product portfolio that is wholly or in large part sustainably made, right? They are putting mechanisms in place, and not just Nike, but like Coca-Cola, L'Oreal, which is a French-based company, but Procter & Gamble and Unilever, which is a Dutch-based company. A lot of these consumer product good companies, they're really taking seriously this idea of what materials they're putting into their products so that it is easy for consumers to recycle them at the end of life, like toothpaste tubes or makeup, you know, like moisturizing makeup. You know, they're using paper-based sources or bio-based materials, right? So they're easily recycled. It's a behemoth project. They make so many goods, right? It's hard to extend this very quickly across their entire portfolio of products, but they're taking sustainability and circularity of products seriously, for sure.
In terms of the packaging, you know, there's so much plastic used, and plastic is based on petrochemicals and oil. Like, obviously petrochemicals and plastics came into popularity and existence after World War II, but how do we move away from replacing that as a tool to deliver product into something that's more, you mentioned toothpaste tube. I can't imagine, how do you transport toothpaste if it's not in some sort of a tight, inflexibly designed, you know, tube like that? How do you do that? I mean, I've seen plastic bottles. That's not any better. You really can't use paper, you know. How do we make that transition to something else which doesn't decompose while it's sitting on the shelf?
Yeah, it's hard. I always say, I'm not sure we're going to get rid of plastics. I think we just have to manage them really well. Mm-hmm. That said, there is some extremely innovative companies out there that are trying to replace some aspects of different types of plastic, right? There's the when you look at plastic, they're right now coded number one through seven, right? Seven is a hodgepodge of crazy amount of diversity of plastic, right? So these thermoplastics they're just amalgamations of different types of materials that go in there. And so it's really hard to recycle that. You just can't right now. Mm. Plastic number one through five, they can be recycled. Styrofoam is a terrible plastic because it breaks up and it flies away, it's super light and decontaminates everything, right? The air, the land, the water. We could get rid of some plastics. Right now we're doing a fairly decent job. We actually have to get the industry, the recycling industry, profitable, up and running for certain plastics, like number one, number two, and four, right? These are highly recyclable, right? Three, four, five times before they degrade too far. Number one is used in Coke bottles, for instance, you know, water bottles. So we have a process to do that. Two and four are films or like detergent bottles. We have a process to recycle them. We just have to make them profitable. We have to get that industry and that supply chain working correctly. Mm-hmm. And we have to make sure that that recycled plastic is cheaper or on par to virgin plastic. That has been the issue, that we can recycle these types of plastics, but they're way more expensive. And so companies are cost driven. So they go with virgin again. Now, these other like six and seven plastics, they're just hard to manage and they're in everything, right? Make it really durable. Like think about cosmetics. They often, like a one little pump bottle of moisturizer could have 14 different plastics in there.
Wow.
They do certain things, you know, the right way. How do you actually disassemble that? It's really difficult. So we need to get our chemical recycling industry up and running. Now, it's an old technology. It's been around for 25, 30 years. But back in the day, they said, it's not profitable. We cannot make this industry profitable, this chemical recycling of plastic. But we're going to have to figure that out. And then ultimately, we have to think of plastics as commodity products, you know, literally like bought and sold on the financial markets, so that they can stay within the system. They have value, they're priced, right? And we keep it within the technical system, the value chain, so they don't go to landfill, so they don't keep on getting produced and contaminating the earth. That's how we have to think about plastic, while innovating to replace it.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at like some sort of carbon tax that focuses on virgin plastic, and again, increasing the cost because there's obviously a more direct relationship to the oil at that point, but the cost of the other plastics being lower, it could change the dynamics in terms of what's driving the companies to use a particular form of one or another. So at least it would help in that regard. So
I know carbon taxes are so toxic in the United States. I mean, I think they're necessary, but what was interesting with what is going to about to pass either today or tomorrow, right? The Inflation Reduction Act, is that there were a lot of carrots in there. There were a lot of incentives to move to renewable and built infrastructure to support sustainability for the entire economy. Less sticks, right? I think we need both. But if we can, I mean, plastic is it's a tough problem that we have to solve.
Wow. It's a lot to take on. And, you know, I honor your embracing of the challenge. How many companies have you worked with so far in terms of helping them look at this kind of an issue with your company?
Well, my company is about 4 years old. I've probably worked with, 40 to 50 at this point, and a variety of different issues. I mean, it's not all circularity. I wish it were. A lot of it is starting from the very beginning and saying, hey, let's do a carbon inventory and look at your footprint and figure out what levers we can pull to make you more efficient, to move you in that sustainable direction. I love the circularity projects. I love the end of life, programs that companies put in play. I always say, I can do this for you, but let's look upstream and try to figure out how you can actually design a better product so that it's easy to be recycled. It's been fun. It's been fun so far.
Well, if COVID and the Russian crisis have taught us anything, it's that businesses need to be more efficient and more proactive in terms of what they're going to try to do in terms of their business and for the economy. So, if people want to reach out to you, to learn more and to hopefully, embrace this kind of an approach, how can they reach out to you?
So they can go to my website, my corporate website, www.triplewinadvisory.com. They can also, if they're interested, we didn't even talk about my book, but if they're interested in personal sustainability, community sustainability, they can also go to kategartner.com and check out a bunch of free resources there and how to become more sustainable as an individual.
Awesome. Well, you just queued it up. That's our second show. So we'll do that in another month or two.
Okay.
All right. But I didn't even cross my mind, but that's food for thought. Kate, thanks for taking the time to chat today. And like I said, we'll revisit you and talk about your book. Give me some time to read it in the next month or so.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was great to talk with you.
Sounds good. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Take care.